Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with the longtime voice of Peak Oil and Energy Sanity, Richard Heinberg. We're talking about his new book on fracking, Snake Oil. Well, who is behind these never-ending press stories that America can have 200 years' worth of energy from fracking or be the new Saudi Arabia? It's fantastic stuff.
It is, and it's mostly these small companies that have led the charge. Chesapeake Energy, for example, for up until the last few months, its CEO was a guy named Aubrey McClendon, and he was famous for talking up the potential of shale gas. He testified before Congress. He wrote op-eds for the Wall Street Journal. You know, his voice was very prominent in all of this. And, you know, when he made these claims, they weren't really attached to any scientific studies. It was mostly just, you know, trust us, we're in the business. And so you find President Obama parroting basically the same line, saying that the U.S. has 100 years of natural gas, when there's no real data to back that up. This is really why I wrote the book. The title, Snake Oil, is not about the oil and gas per se that we're talking about. It's about the hype. It's about the inflated claims that have been made for shale gas and tight oil, and how those claims are undermining sound energy policy at all levels of government.
And you've talked about the work that Post Carbon Institute did before you wrote this. Tell us about the David Hughes report, Drill Baby Drill.
Sure. Yes. My book is largely based on this report. And David Hughes is a retired petroleum geologist who worked for the Canadian Geological Survey. And in that job, he prepared major reports for the Canadian government, crunching lots of numbers having to do with production of natural gas, coal, and other fossil fuels. So he's very well acquainted with the terrain. He has the analytic skills to be able to do a report like this. We really wanted to find out what was at the bottom of the shale boom. And as I mentioned earlier, we bought the rights to data on all of these wells. We bought them from a company in Austin, Texas, Drilling Info. And we produced what I think is, as far as I've been able to tell, the most comprehensive report or study that's been done to date on shale gas and tight oil, including by the International Energy Agency and the U.S. Department of Energy. And that 180-page report is available as a free PDF download. You can go to shalebubble.org, that's shalebubble.org, and download and read it for yourself. My book, Snake Oil, is basically an effort to put that information into layman's terms and then draw conclusions and also look at a few other aspects of fracking, like the environmental impacts and the Wall Street connection.
Could you, Richard Heinberg, please describe for us what Hughes calls the treadmill to hell, that constant need to drill more and more and more wells?
Right. Well, this comes from the high decline rates. All oil and gas wells decline in production over time. So if you drill a well in January, chances are by December of the same year, production of oil or gas will already have started to decline a little bit. Well, in the case of shale wells, particularly once you get outside of the sweet spots, the core areas, the decline rates are savage. We're talking about 60, 70, 80% decline in production in the very first year. So in order to even keep overall production steady on a straight line, it's necessary to drill and drill and drill. This is why we're talking about so many wells already having been drilled and lining up ready to be drilled. It's not as though the shale oil and gas industry can just drill a few wells and produce all of this product that they're talking about. They've already drilled tens of thousands of wells, and by the time all of this is over, they will have drilled many tens of thousands more with all of the attendant environmental risks and investment costs. Each of these wells, as I think I mentioned earlier, may cost $10 million to drill. We'll multiply that by 100,000. That's $1 trillion. And that gives you some sense of how much is being invested in this shale phenomenon.
Yeah, and you're right that each well has to burn about 2,000 gallons of diesel oil a day just to keep the rig running. What are some of the main environmental impacts? We won't be able to go into all of them, but maybe you could touch on what fracking does.
A lot of it has to do with water, both sourcing water, because it takes 3 or 4 million gallons to frack each well. So in places that have water shortages like Colorado and Wyoming, Texas and Oklahoma and so on, that's a problem just getting the water, because the frackers are in competition with agriculture and city water use and so on. But also there's the problem of what to do with the water once you've fracked. You have to take the water up out of the well in order to start producing oil or gas. Well, what do you do with it then? It has all these chemicals in it. It also has pollutants that have been picked up deep underground, very often radioactive elements. So do you put it in a holding pond and let it evaporate? Well, the holding ponds leak. Well, do you send it to a water treatment plant? Well, water treatment plants aren't prepared to deal with these kinds of pollutants. You can inject it back down deep underground into old oil or gas wells, and the industry likes to do that. But in that case, what you're doing is taking perfectly good fresh water, which is more and more at a premium these days, polluting it, and then taking it out of the hydrological cycle where it can never be used again. So there's no good answer to that problem. There are other environmental problems as well having to do with air quality and human health, health of pets and livestock and wildlife that have all been traced, documented to fracking.
And we do have to now consider deep ground ecology. There is life down there, maybe bacterial life, plus important networks of water. Will those million-old wells, if we get that many, will they leak? Will they create unwanted pathways for underground change?
There is a study that was published in a peer-reviewed industry journal suggesting, just a couple of years ago, suggesting that evidence is coming down on the side that says that eventually just about all oil and gas wells will leak. I mean, during the period in which the oil or gas well is actually being used, it's producing, if it's properly drilled, properly cased and cemented, chances are there won't be any contact between the well bore and the water table. But that's a pretty brief stretch of time. We're talking about maybe 10 years, something like that, maybe 20 years. What happens after that? Well, of course, the well is plugged and abandoned. But the well casing may fail decades, centuries afterward, and at that point, there's every possibility for water table to be contaminated by the oil or gas or by other chemicals.
You know, I was just thinking about this. Richard Heinberg, a lot of your life, your research, your books are about the underground world from oil to coal. I wonder, why did you spend so much time looking downward?
Right. Well, I never really thought about it that way, you know. My interest in fossil fuels has nothing to do with some inherent fascination with geology. I didn't even study geology in school. My interest is in energy and social, environmental, historic, political implications of energy. And fossil fuels have been the biggest energy story of the millennium. I mean, there's been nothing before them that were anything like fossil fuels, and we probably will never have anything like them again. They're changing the climate. They've completely altered the economy of the world. And most people just take them for granted. So, you know, to me, this is not something to be taken for granted. We're living in an extraordinary moment in human history. And if we don't understand the role of fossil fuels in this moment, then we're just not getting it.
We can't leave fracking without talking about the myth that could drive us all into an overheated extinction, and that is that fracked natural gas is a bridge fuel and a cleaner alternative to coal. Is that true?
I don't believe so. There's a lot of controversy on this. There have been studies that say that methane being a more powerful greenhouse gas than CO2, that methane leaking from fracked natural gas wells is coming out in such quantities that it does away with any possible climate advantage to switching over to generating electricity from natural gas as opposed to coal. Then there are other studies coming out, mostly funded by the natural gas industry, that say, no, the leakage is very small and there is a tremendous climate advantage to burning natural gas. The scientists are going to be trying to sort this out for some time. It appears to me that the industry-funded studies are being very carefully constructed to look only at natural gas wells that are properly drilled and cased and cemented, where nothing is going wrong. And some of the other measurements that show very high leakage are probably taking into account wells where, you know, everything wasn't done exactly according to standard. And so we may find at the end of the day that, in fact, the folks who are raising the alarm about natural gas leakage are in fact, onto something. But in any case, the promise of natural gas as a bridge fuel rests entirely on the assumption that we have enough of the stuff to be able to burn it instead of coal for decades to come while we gradually, slowly build a renewable energy economy, maybe by mid-century or so. Well, you know, we don't, in fact, have that much natural gas. If our study at Post Carbon Institute is correct, you know, before the end of this decade, we'll be seeing declining production of natural gas. That's not a bridge fuel. It's a bridge to nowhere. It's a gangplank.
And as we might expect from a senior fellow at the Post Carbon Institute, you do write about an alternative energy reality. You call it hydrocarbon rehab. Do you want to give us a sneak peek, a quick snapshot? What are you talking about there?
In our future, we will have less in the way of fossil fuels, no matter what we do. We will have a renewable energy future by the end of this century, one way or another, whether we've planned for it and worked for it, or whether it's just a matter of using all the fossil fuels we can afford to get out of the ground and then letting the economy collapse in a dead heap. A better way to go would, of course, obviously be to build that renewable energy economy proactively, starting now, starting 10 years ago, starting 20 years ago, if we could. Obviously, we can't, but we can at least start now. And it's really the only way we can ensure a sound economic future. Otherwise, we're handcuffing ourselves to an energy economy that has no future.
Can you please just give us a couple of websites where people can follow your work?
Absolutely. A good one is resilience.org. That's our institutional website for Post Carbon Institute. And also, if folks are interested in the book Snake Oil, they can find out more about that also on my website, which is richardheinberg.com.
Richard's the longtime author of the online journal The Muse Letter. He's been the voice of the peak oil movement with books like The Party's Over and Peak Everything. We've been talking about his latest of 10 books, Snake Oil, How Fracking's False Promise of Plenty Imperils Our Future. It's a good read, packed with facts we all ought to know. Richard, thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
It's a pleasure, Alex. Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. We wrap up this Radio EcoShock show with another voice the mainstream media misses. Another eco-activist, youth headed for this year's power shift in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, October 18th to 21st. Get the details at wearepowershift.org.
We all know the game from childhood. Rock beat scissor, scissor beat paper, paper beat rock beat scissor, etc., etc. What you don't understand is that the 1% of this planet uses the paper game to control all things generation, generation, generation. I invite you global people to come together like rock, five finger, form fist, and destroy this absolute tyranny. Don't drill into Mother Earth, don't create this chaos. Rock go strike Goliath dead. Pull back the sling.
Rock Beats Paper featuring Kevin Mambo, released September 25th on BlackSwanSounds.com. We find Brian Menifee, already a leader in Washington, D.C., as a Howard University senior. Brian, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me.
When you talk about the environment, you always seem to talk about justice, too. Why is that?
Well, I think about when you want to talk about the environment, you have to talk about justice, because when you talk about different things that are, I guess you could say, going wrong with the environment, it's an issue about justice. You know, when you talk about oil refinement or getting raw materials from the earth, most of the places that they do it in are in places where the people do not have the political power to stop these things from happening. When you look at the tar sands on the Indigenous Peoples Reservation, when you talk about communities located in the Gulf Coast region where the pipeline is actually supposed to end at, a lot of these communities where it's happening in, don't have the political power to prevent these kind of environmental disasters from happening. So yeah, that's why I think when you're thinking about the environment, you always have to think about justice. Because when you think about justice, then you can start kind of connecting the dots with other issues that aren't really kind of talked about, you know, such as police brutality, you know, income, the disparity of income and the wealth gap, because I think all those things are connected when you're talking about the degradation of our environment.
Well, I think there's two big parts to that. And one you've raised, which is we want people to have a vote about climate change, but a lot of African Americans don't have the vote. And we know white people commit the majority of crimes, yet people of color are more than half of the prison population. When they come out, they can't vote. So that disenfranchises people from their own country, I feel. What's your feeling on it?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And of course, with that, I mean, you can clearly see that implementation of, you know, if you have a felony, then you cannot vote, just another way and tactic to give people who don't have anything to have even less, you know what I'm saying, to make as a people, to see them as criminals and as people that should not be able to participate in society. And then, like you said, I mean, it disproportionately affects Black people and people of color. And I mean, I definitely think that that's just, you know, another way, because I mean, we can all see that the prison system is a way for people to make money off of us. Yeah, I mean, it's a tragedy.
It is a tragedy. And you raised the other point I was thinking of, which is we had a guest on Radio EcoShock who explained the reality in Harlem. And she said, if you need a place to put a dirty truck terminal or a waste disposal company or even a coal-fired power plant, you just dump it in the African-American community. And have you seen that?
Oh, yeah, definitely. There in Washington, D.C., there's a community in the northeast part of Washington, D.C. It's a predominantly Black community called River Terrace. And basically, they're going to put a bus depot in this River Terrace community. It was going to be like some mega buses, you know, buses that like basically go up and down the East Coast. There's going to be a bus depot there. So it's going to be 24-hour buses going in and out. Not to mention the kind of, you know, the CO2 emissions from the buses, but the noise aspect of having a bus depot in the community. But the community fought back and the bus depot didn't end up being built in that community. But yeah, I mean, it happens all of the time. I mean, if you want a bus depot, if you want to, you know, find somewhere to put an incinerator, it's usually going to be put in a people of color community or somewhere out in the outskirts, you know what I'm saying? So, yeah.
Well, you know, most of the developed countries are getting so that 1% of the very rich people and 99% just get poorer by the day. That was the theme of the Occupy movement. What did you think of that, Occupy?
I guess we all have, I guess, some kind of ups and downs about the Occupy movement. I think the Occupy movement sparked a lot of people to see that there's another way to do things. And I think a lot of people were affected not only by just like seeing how people were coming together and standing up, but also like, you know, when people visited these kind of autonomous communities all throughout the United States, they saw how people were having meetings, how people were like holding different things, like showing that there's another way to live than the way that we're kind of like portrayed or that we're taught to in school. I mean, I think the Occupy movement, there was some good things about it. I think for the most part, it was a lot of people that, I guess, a lot of privileged people that weren't used to, I guess, things that people of color and people without privilege are used to. So, you know, in this time, you know, since the disparity of wealth, now people are saying, oh, there's no more jobs, or, oh, I can't get hired at this place, or, oh, I went to college and spent all this money on the education, but I still can't get a job. And it's like, well, now you're in our shoes. This is like how it's been for us for decades, you know, since we've come to this country. So I think for a lot of people, it's a realization to like what a lot of people in this country and around the world feel on a day-to-day basis. But I think it was a movement, and I think we got to like move forward.
All right. Now, let's talk about Power Shift. Do you see that as a movement? And if so, what is Power Shift doing?
I think Power Shift can be a movement. I think what its goals are, what its aims, especially this Power Shift, trying to reach out to frontline communities, people of color. They're trying to reach out to historically Black colleges and universities to kind of come and contribute. I think that's a step forward in a process to bring a lot of different people from a lot of different backgrounds together in one place and kind of just talk about the things that we're facing and how we can come together to kind of change the system that we're in. So I definitely think that power shift and more things like power shift need to happen to bring a lot of people from a lot of different backgrounds come together to talk about things, but also network and exchange information so that we can build this kind of network of people that are trying to change the system that we live in today.
Well, we just heard on Radio EcoShock from a person who thought Washington was just getting too hot for too long to live outside of anything that's air-conditioned. Do the students realize climate change is happening, and what's going on at Howard University?
I think for a lot of students, I mean, climate change is definitely real. Maybe not to the point of being able to articulate it, but I think of a lot of people understand, especially people at Howard University that have come from the Gulf Coast who were there for Katrina, who were there for a lot of the hurricanes that have hit the Gulf Coast over the last few years. You know, communities who are coming from the South in general, from Florida, you know, because I know they get hit with hurricanes pretty often. I think they understand the reality of, like, what happens when Mother Earth is not is not doing well. And then I think coming together at Howard University and having that kind of experience, being exposed to a lot of different things and a lot of teachers and a lot of books that you're not really given a chance to read in, like, a public educational system, or, in my opinion, any kind of, like, other educational system that doesn't put forward a lot of different kind of, like, writers and artists other than kind of, like, white males. You know what I'm saying? So I think when you get people together like that, I think people are more aware and more conscious about what's happening to the environment. And it's definitely on people's minds about how, you know, they can see how the climate is changing, not only in Washington, D.C., but they're kind of seeing, like, different things happen, these floods and these fires happening. And I think with, like, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, and, like, kind of all of these social media that, like, kind of, like, when anything happens, it's like, basically right there in their fingertips. So I really do think that people, especially at Howard University, are more aware to what's going on, and they're starting to, like, kind of, like, oh, yeah, you know, these things are connected, you know what I'm saying? Just my opinion from being around in the student body, it's definitely a connection being made about we need to be more aware about the climate, and we need to do something about it, and not just, you know, kind of like, oh, you know, maybe the next generation will do something.
Yeah, well, you talk about storms. A lot of people don't realize D.C. almost got nailed by Hurricane Sandy. It just happened to go a little further up the coast before it turned inland. And what happened in New England could have flooded Washington, the Potomac, Chesapeake Bay. It's just a matter of time before these violent storms hit. But it's so hard to tell people that.
Yeah, it definitely is. And it's another thing, too, is that all across the United States, the infrastructure system is horrible. Like, when you talk about the levees in New Orleans, or when you talk about, you know, even in Washington, D.C. still basically, like, the sewer system and the drains on the street drain right into the Chesapeake Bay. Like, anytime there's a big, like, flash flood or anything like that, the wastewater treatment facilities can't hold the water that's coming into it. So they basically just, like, let everything flow into the river. I mean, and you can understand of, like, how raw sewage can affect the ecosystem just on that, like, kind of micro scale level. So, yeah, like, if a storm like Sandy could come through, I mean, it could really damage not only the infrastructure, but the ecosystem in general.
Well, you know, I was talking with someone about this whole thing of the heating up and the drying out of the South, and he was of the opinion, he was an African-American cook, as a matter of fact, that we had on the program. He was of the opinion that really African-Americans were going to be able to adapt better than all the white people were. What's your thoughts on that?
I could understand that for a degree, because I think as African-Americans, we've been able to kind of deal with kind of, like, harsh realities. I'm not saying that all African-Americans have the same experience, because that's not true. But I definitely think that people who grow up without as much privilege are able to cope and deal with kind of a changing environment more than people who have, like, kind of gone up with privilege and gone up with a sense of entitlement that, you know, think things are going to be this certain way. And when they don't end up being that certain way, they kind of just, like, freak out and, like, oh, I don't know what to do. you know, just kind of like taking their hands off the steering wheel and just letting whatever happens, happens, instead of like taking control of the situation, figuring out, okay, you know, this is going to happen. We need to do this. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So, I do think I know where he's coming from when he says that.
Well, all right. So why are you going to this Power Shift meetup in Pittsburgh?
Well, personally, I want to go to this Power Shift because I think it'll be a good way to network with people who have, with like-minded people who have basically the same goal, you know, the same goal to try to change the system that we're in right now, the same goal to kind of like change the surroundings that we are, because we feel like that there is a different way of living. There's a different way of interacting with people than what we're on, what we're doing right now. So for me, it's, you know, it's connecting, you know, Black students, it's connecting basically everybody that's coming to Power Shift together and creating a network, a solid network of people that are trying to uplift and change things. Because I think although we need to uplift and put forth the frontline communities and, you know, let that struggle be known, it's going to take everybody coming together to kind of like facilitate a new change of this system.
And have you got some plans on or thoughts what you're going to do after you graduate?
Actually, I have no idea. I'm studying mechanical engineering, and so I'll be graduating in December. But I actually have no ideas. I've been doing kind of like research and like have more aligned my studies with like energy and kind of water purification, specifically water access in Palestine. But yeah, I'm not really sure where I'm not going to go.
Well, water access in Palestine, you know something. Take it from me, Brian. Once you become a troublemaker at a young age, it never leaves you. You just can't accept that bad things are going on. You're always looking for justice. Are you really ready for that?
I think so.
It's been great talking with you. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. We've been talking with Brian Menifee from Washington, D.C. Join us next week for more Radio EcoShock in our first broadcast from the mountains. All our music this week is from the new album Rock Beats Paper by Earthrise Sound System from Black Swan Sounds. Get the links you need from my show blog at ecoshock.info. If you know a station that should be carrying Radio EcoShock, please write me. The address is radio@ecoshock.org. Download all our past programs as free MP3s at our website, ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for your support, and a special thanks for caring about your world.
Yeah, Earthrise Sound System, Street Color, Duke Mushroom on the Hook, SCC.